There are 28 chapters in Matthew. We are in Matthew 24. The end is in sight. Unfortunately, there's not much good news in these last four chapters. There's not many things to rejoice about. Say, that was a really good move. You know, well done. And so it can be a little depressing. So that's why I told you my story about the Valdez thing, so that you'd have a little laughter before I got into the depressing part. So although we are past the woes, woe to you, or woe for you, that we had looked at in Matthew 23. If you remember last week, we finished in Matthew. I added the verse to the top of the sheet here, if you have the sheet. And we'll read that as he finishes. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And for those that you were here last week, you remember we pointed out that just a few days earlier, this is what they had shouted to him when he entered the city of Jerusalem. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And all of a sudden, now he is experiencing rejection from certainly the religious leaders, and shortly to follow, almost everybody in Jerusalem. The phrase, see, your house is left to you desolate, doesn't seem like a right phrase to them, because it's not desolate. Right now, when they're there, it is the center of Jewish culture, of Jewish religion, of Jewish government, of Jewish activity. Quite a structure it was. But he is lamenting over it. He knows that they will eventually recognize him for who he is. This response is in deep pain. It's of the wounded heart. I don't think any of us see sin like God sees sin, so none of us experience the pain over it that he experiences. God's love and his righteous acts that were demonstrated through Jesus Christ and offered through Jesus Christ have been rejected. Jesus knows what this means. He knows what the end result will be. It means disaster, pain, and suffering for the children of Israel again. They will not listen. How many times have we seen this in the Old Testament? They continually reject God. He knows what the end result's going to be, but they choose it anyway. To a limited extent, we have experienced this in our own lives. How many of you know someone who you really cared for and you hoped they wouldn't make that really foolish decision, and yet they did? We tried to reach out with biblical truth. We tried to touch them with the hope that we have that we think would save them, but they chose to not go that direction. We have watched them refuse truth and look inside themselves for the answer. And this is the danger point. This is when I talked about not having the reference point. When we just look inside of ourselves for the answer, all we end up with is ourselves. And that isn't sufficient to solve the significant problems that we have. The Bible, and even my own pragmatic experience, says this is going to be disaster. For many young people, I have seen disaster coming, and yet my words, and maybe your words as a parent, or a friend, or a counselor, were not heeded. We hurt for the pain that's coming. We know that it's coming, not just for now, but maybe it's coming for the rest of their lives, and maybe it's coming for generations, the result of the choice they're going to make. But they choose it anyway. Just as Jesus knows here that the children of Israel are going to make the wrong choice here. And it's going to end up in serious disaster. If you're thinking about what God allows and doesn't allow, this passage might also cause you to consider that he allows us to move outside of his hopes for us. Everything is not predestined to the point exactly what he would want. He hoped for them to make a wise choice. They didn't make it, and he allows it, even at the risk of destroying themselves. I was walking at a cross-country meet, actually, with a non-believer, and I happened to see a Christian coach come by, and he said, I said, good luck. And he goes, well, it's not a matter of luck. It's whatever God has predestined. So he was taking it that far, that whoever wins will be predestined to win. I thought, well, shoot, why even train, you know? But anyway, but I just, and I'd witnessed to the guy I was with a long time. And I know, and he comes from a religious background, same as some of you come from. But he doesn't have a relationship with God right now. And I said, I almost said his name there, I didn't. I said, do you think that it takes a bigger God to make automatons or to give us the ability to choose? And he said, oh, it'd take a way bigger God to give us the ability to choose. And that's why God feels pain, because he knows he's giving them the ability to choose, and they're going to choose exactly what they should not. So we're in chapter 24 now. So let's look at those first verses, the verses 1 through 3. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another. They shall, that shall not be thrown down. So as Jesus walks out of that temple, he is saying he will never again enter into that temple until he is recognized as the Lord. And remember that last verse of chapter 23, that with all capitals there, it's that Yahweh or Jehovah or whatever term that means the personal covenant relationship with the children of Israel, not just an impersonal name for God. So he's walking away. It's the beginning of the end. They have rejected him, and he is accepting that because he knows that as a result of their rejection, he will be able to pay the final sacrifice and reunite people with him. It's interesting. His disciples came to him and to show him the buildings of the temple. I thought it was an interesting phrase. It's like he didn't notice, you know, or whatever. The temple structure was extraordinarily beautiful. They were so proud of it. No expense had been spared. It was huge. The stones were of the purest white. It was said that from a distance, it looked like it was white as snow. Up close, it had some green flecks in it. Many parts were gilded in gold, and this was a huge structure. It was built as a replacement for Solomon's temple. The historian Josephus says several of the stones were 45 cubits in length, 5 in height, and 6 in breadth. That means that some of the individual stones were more than 70 feet long, 10 feet wide, and 8 feet high, and beautifully painted. There's some serious stones they put together to create that. If you've seen any pictures of the Wailing Wall, and somebody has been there, I know, I hear this every time. So you see that those stones look like they've been picked from all over. It's not all of one kind. So it's just a representative of some of the stones that were left from the structure there. So this prophecy that it's going to be destroyed and not one stone shall be left upon another is a destruction of a very beautiful thing and the identity of their nation. And he doesn't only predict that will be destroyed, but he's also going to predict persecution for them as well. So what was going through the mind of the disciples while they were showing him this? Were they hoping he would change his mind, that they could convince him this is a thing worth saving? I don't really know what their purpose was to show them, but he's telling them that the end result is going to be disaster. The temple was their point, single point of pride over everything else for the Jewish nation, and Jesus predicted its doom. I came across a quote about it. It said, he who has never seen the temple of Herod has never seen a fine building. And this is from the first century. For those of you who can picture it in your mind, many of you have seen a photograph of the Dome of the Rock, which is where the temple used to be, you know, the long wall, and there's the dome sitting there. And that's usually taken from the mount that he's going to, the Mount of Olives that he comes to in verse 30. There's a valley between them. I think it's the Valley of Kidron. It's just a few hundred yards away. You can see that beautiful structure, and that's where they've gone to. And they just can't imagine that that structure is not going to be there, because they have the same idea that American Christians often get, is that somehow we're good enough and God will always spare us. But I don't think that the Jews at this time were very close to what God intended. And sparing certainly wasn't something that he was going to do. But they couldn't imagine it being gone. Some of you know, if you know a little bit about the history, just 40 years later, when Emperor Titus comes down to squelch the Jewish rebellion, he actually tried as the emperor to save the temple, but the fever was so intense against the Jewish nation that the soldiers came in and just completely demolished it. No stone was left upon another. It was said that after that had happened, that those who visited could hardly believe that it had ever been inhabited. So Jesus' prophecy here, just 40 years later, comes to fruition. When you look down at that wall with the temple on top of it, there's a gate there, and it's called the Eastern Gate. And most of you have seen pictures of it. It's sealed up right now. And Ezekiel prophesies that someday he will return through that gate. But for now, Jesus is still not welcome in that city on that mount. So he moves to the temple, Mount of Olives. Let's read verse 3. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" So they're sitting on that mountain. There isn't much trees there, so it's just wide open. The view's right there. They're looking to the west. And their sacred temple is going to be gone, and they want to know more about it. Now, we've often criticized the disciples for not having faith in Jesus, right? Not until after Jesus died and he came back. But obviously, these guys are pretty much believing what he says is going to happen. They want to know about it. So they ask three questions. They ask, when will these things be done? And what will be the sign of your coming and the signs of the end of the age? And these are certainly logical questions. If we're going to lose our nation as we know it, if everything we know and identify with is going to be gone, what will we have to cling to? What will this look like? What will be our role in it? Because it's certainly not the role they intended to have originally. They thought they were going to sit at Jesus' right hand and Jesus' left hand and be his main group when he overthrew the Romans, and they had even a greater national presence than they had now. And all of a sudden, it's not looking at all like they thought it was going to look like. And what are they going to do with that? And I would think that as your spiritual life personally grows, you'll start to see that some of the things that you thought Jesus was going to give you, you're not going to get. I've mentioned it once before. I had an individual in my office, and this individual said, "If I accept Jesus, will he give me back my spouse who had left?" See, so the idea, if I follow Jesus, I will get. If he becomes Lord, then he's strong. He will give me the things that I want. Well, what happens when all of a sudden your faith starts to say, okay, I'm not getting those things that I thought I was going to get? I still have to go to work. My husband still yells at me. We still disagree on occasion. Then all of a sudden we have to start redefining our faith, and this is where maturity comes from. The things that would have disappointed us early on, we can move through at later years because we have some maturity, we have some belief. Okay, that isn't what God promised me. God didn't promise me to make my spouse an automaton because he didn't make me an automaton. Therefore, if he's going to let me respond, I'm going to let this other person respond. So our own life matures, we start to see things that we didn't see. And this is the process that the disciples are trying to struggle to get through. This sounds really rough. They know what war is. Their history is one of absolute brutality time and time again toward their nation. There's no reason why they should look forward to this. They seem to believe, and let's read in verse 4. We will answer these questions a little bit as Jesus did. And these are some complex answers that will take some time to get through. But in verses 4 through 8, he says, "And Jesus answered and said, 'Take heed that no one deceives you.'" Well, if his first response is that, "Take heed that no one deceives you," it means that there's certainly going to be a number of people out there trying to deceive you, trying to lead you astray. "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will deceive many." Remember, "I am the Christ" means I am the Messiah. I am the answer to your problems. "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. And all these are the beginning of sorrows." See, I think the tendency of the disciples is to believe that as soon as the temple goes down, then Christ will come in and issue the new kingdom and they'll get what they want. It'll just be without the temple. But they still have a pretty hard learning curve because they still have no feel for the kingdom of heaven, which the kingdom of heaven is what goes on inside of us that should make us radically different people than if we didn't have the kingdom of heaven inside of us. So if I look out at you or you look at me, and we look just like every other American who doesn't have God in their life, then I submit to you that the kingdom of heaven isn't going to be visible. Is that logical? That makes sense? So there has to be something in us that is so radically different that it's undeniable that the kingdom of heaven, as God intended it, not a physical kingdom with stuff, but an internal, completely change of my responses, how I react to the stimulus around me, how I react when my parents are unfair, or how I react when my kids are impolite, or how I react when my best friend betrays me, or how I react when my spouse is not kind. These are the things that should have marked, that they should have understand that God was really after. These are the things, the heart of God that he talks about all through the Old Testament. In fact, if you think of the heroes of the Old Testament, these guys aren't guys and girls that did that didn't make big mistakes, right? The guys that are held up as heroes, I mean, I was reading about David and Solomon this week, and the Lord condemns Solomon for not being like his servant David. And I never thought David was all that sharp myself, but you know, I mean, he was a good guy though. I mean, as far as his heart toward God, he just, you know, stole somebody else's wife and had him killed and a few things like that, but it's not a big deal. See, apparently God is judging by a different standard. He knows they made critical big mistakes, but he knows what the heart intent was down deep inside. And that's what moves God to say somebody like Abraham or David or these people are people with a heart after God versus people who just look kind of successful in their religious or Christian perspective. So he's trying to get them off the idea, because see, even though they realize now he's not going to lead that and they're not going to sit inside the temple and be big shots, they think, well, when it's gone, then we'll be big shots. And he's saying, no. In fact, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to be persecuted. And he starts off in verse 9 talking about that. They have no feel for that kingdom. And what gets you to the place where stuff and experiences aren't your bottom line and don't define who you are? Most of us take a little pride in something that we've done. You know, I did this or I did that, or I built this canal to my house to get my float plane there. I thought that was cool. You know, just different things that we all do. You know, I make the very best donuts in the world. You know, these are, I had to do that because Bob's back with us today. But, see, we take some pride in that, and that's okay. To a point, but that shouldn't define who we are, right? If that defines who we are, we've missed the idea of the kingdom. I don't know how the church, whether you think of this group of a body or just God's kingdom out there, is going to get anywhere. I held up that book a few months ago, you know, The Last Christian Generation. If all we have is what we do and what we have as signs of the kingdom, I don't think that our faith is going to carry very well. Because you can get all we have and do all we do without being part of the kingdom. Does that make sense? So then physical wealth, although we can certainly be thankful for it, as we know as Christians, all good things come from God, we realize that's not his main emphasis. So I can rejoice in what I have, but if I'm not becoming conformed to his image, if I'm not understanding that that's his kingdom, then I'm missing the point. And they're missing the point, and they've been missing the point, but Jesus is very patient with them. And to take somebody, because he's very patient with us as well, to take somebody and to try to rearrange their whole paradigm shift and shift them to something else is a huge undertaking. They're thinking short term. Jesus is thinking long term. This whole chapter and a little bit more is called the Olivet Discourse. You may have heard this phrase. Just want to identify that in case you have. That's what this is referring to. It's been titled by theologians, but it is really the preparation of the disciples. These and the next few parables, he goes into a few parables again, are the preparation for what it's going to be like when he's gone. It's his last chance to teach the disciples what they need to know when he's going to be gone. They think it's going to be short. He's just going to be gone for a little while, but he's going to be gone for a long time. Let's look. So we read about not being deceived. We'll look at that a little bit more along with 9 through 14. We don't have a lot of time this morning, so we're going to have to end it pretty quick. And then we'll pick that up with a little more definition next week. But let's read verses 9 through 14. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Now, here's the bad news. If you thought you were going to be a big shot setting on Jesus as the all-powerful ones left and right hand side, and now he lays this on you, you're like, I think fishing is a good thing to be doing right now. That carpentry gig that I had before, that'll be okay. You know, maybe I want to, you know, I don't know. Did they have concrete guys back then? I suppose, you know, they made blocks or something. I don't know. You know, I'm thinking about going back to the concrete thing. So anyway, it's a concrete idea anyway. They will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. They will betray each other and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise and deceive many. And because the lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. And then the end will come. We're not going to read verse 15 through 22. We'll read that next time. The description even gets more pointed and even more gloomy. If all of human existence is viewed by evil and good, God and the devil, as a contention for you, then you have to come to the understanding that this isn't heaven on earth. And that's what he's trying to teach him. You're not going to have heaven on earth. In fact, they didn't want it. We've said it before. If I give you contentment now, you'll not long for heaven. And this is too painful. I don't know how many of you think that this existence is too painful to endure forever, but I do. If not, you must have a really sheltered life. Come with me and I'll introduce you to some unsheltered people. This is a rough life, and it's going to get rougher, and we know it's going to get rougher, and the disciples are learning that. They've had this little interim of peace in Israel, and then things have gone well for a little while. Even though they're not content with Rome, they at least kind of get to do their own little worship thing, and they've got kind of a half Jew and a half Roman in charge, and he kind of favors them in some things as long as he can crush them in others. And it's kind of at least, are any of you content with the government as it presently is? You know, no. See, so we know the idea of being content somewhat, but being dissatisfied somewhat. And that's the situation they're in. But he's telling them this is going to get really bad, really fast, and you're going to live to see it. And if you understand what my kingdom is, you'll have contentment. If not, you will be desperate. By the way, when the city of Jerusalem fell, the Christians had all moved out of there, and they didn't suffer for the tremendous devastation that happened when Rome came and crushed the rebellion against Jerusalem. So I don't want you to think of this just as them, a distant place, a distant history. I want you to try to identify, how am I like those people? And we've already said many times, we are like the Jewish people because we have the religion of our day. We think we're the representative of God to the world in our day. There are many, many comparisons, which means we run the same risks of being cold and disjointed, of being content with religious practice, but not really letting God get down deep in there and change us. I was at a funeral yesterday, and I've known this gentleman for many, 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 many years. And he came out of the Navy, if that tells you anything. He was a very volatile young man. And almost every person that gave a testimony to him at the end of the service said, over the time we knew him, God had done a phenomenal work in conforming him to the image of Christ. Now, they weren't saying he was perfect, but all of a sudden the temper changed and the responses changed and the expectations changed and everything changed because he began to attach himself to the correct reference points. The Jews, the disciples, even as though they followed Jesus for 3 years, had not attached themselves to the correct reference points in life. So they were still hoping for things he didn't promise. And often I find people who are angry with God are angry because they want things that he didn't promise. Do you think God ever promises something and doesn't follow through? No, but we want things and we demand things. I shared that with you once. The one person we knew got ill, and the one family said, we're praying. We told God we demand full healing and we will accept no less. And I thought to myself, ooh, really? You're pretty big stuff, huh? You know, Val and I have been out walking a few nights this week, just kind of bundle up, you know, and the stars have been good. And when I get way out there in, you know, I've got my little bear spray, so I'm, you know, protected against the world. But I feel a little insignificant out there, you know, and God is big. And it would be good if we could align ourselves with what he's doing, what he wants us to do, rather than setting our own agenda. Because that's what the children of Israel had done. The Jews here had set their own agenda. And we, looking back, we know what that agenda is going to lead to, right? Absolute disaster, and yet they cannot see it. They just cannot see it. And I'm hoping that we're not as blind as they are, but I am fearful sometimes we are. And but that's between you and the Lord. How much of his agenda for you, his knowledge, his contact points you're going to try to get, or how much you'll just keep cruising along feeling really pretty good. So if you wanted to be depressed, come back next week. We'll continue in this depressing thing here, and I'll try to make the first part happier. So let's pray. Lord, we do thank you for these reflections about men and women like us who struggled with truth. And we want to walk by faith, and we know that's part of your plan somehow to have us do that. And we want to humble ourselves before you and acknowledge you as God and big, and us as not God and very small. Thank you for your incredible patience and your righteous acts toward us. In Jesus' name, amen.